Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Tuesday evening Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey on September 24th, 2019. This class is class 10 of 32 classes of our structured study of Vipassana, introspective insight into Anicca, Anatta, and Dukkha, the three marks of existence. This talk is on the Dhatuvibhanga Sutta, where the Buddha clearly describes what constitutes a human being. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. So today is, tonight is our 10th class of 32 on the Vipassana, introspective insight into the three marks of existence. This particular sutta is really key to, when taken in the right context of dependent origination and Four Noble Truths, is key to understanding what the Buddha means when he's describing a self. Because that really is what we're dealing with in a Dhamma. What am I? How do I relate to the world around me? And what actually constitutes a self? Notice in the sutta that the Buddha makes no reference at all to a soul, or a common theme of ground of being, meaning something that's permanently established or that can transmigrate from one lifetime to the next. We've never taught anything like that. There's nothing here that describes an inner Buddha nature, another common theme in much of modern Buddhism, or even the ability to develop Buddhahood. Again, something the Buddha didn't teach. All of those are speculative teachings. When you understand what constitutes a self, and you will after the end of the sutta, you'll see that there's no possible way that this self could house a soul, a ground of being, a Buddha nature or Buddhahood, or anything else that's magical, mystical, or superhuman in every way, in any way. This is what we get, folks, for having a human life. And this, the speculative, to speculate in any way to make this difference, this thing that we're going to understand tonight, is the root of all difficulties, the root of all confusion, the root of all greed, aversion, and deluded thinking, is insisting that what this self is something other than what the Buddha describes. And when you can understand that, it clarifies Dhamma practice to the point where it's so easy to recognize what is not me, what is not mine, what is not myself. Because if it's not this, then it's not you. There's another aspect of this that's so important. And those of you that have heard it before know, probably know what I'm about to say. In this sutta, you'll see the playfulness of Siddhartha Gautama. In fact, how playful and I guess the word would be wry, his sense of humor, and you'll see how that plays out. This is called the Dhatuvibhanga Sutta. On one occasion, the Buddha was wandering among the Magadhans. He entered Rajagaha and went to the potter Bhagava. He asked Bhagava, "If it is no inconvenience for you, friend, I will stay for one night in your shed." "It is no inconvenience for me, but the wanderer Pukkasati has already taken up residence there. If he gives his permission, you may stay there as you like." Pukkasati, a fellow Sakyan, that's the Buddha's clan, the Sakyans. Pukkasati, a fellow Sakyan, had gone forth into homelessness and was developing the Buddha's Dhamma. The Buddha approached Pukkasati and asked him if he could stay one night in his shed. Pukkasati replied, "This shed is roomy, my friend. Stay as you like." The Buddha entered the shed and sat on a pile of leaves and grass, folding his legs crosswise and holding his body erect. He set mindfulness to the floor and began jhana, began meditation. Pukkasati joined him in meditation for most of the evening. As morning approached, what?
There's a big spider just going on your back.
All right, he'll go home with me. I brought him.
He probably brought him, yeah.
That's Bodhi's pet. Let me go back. As morning approached, the Buddha had thought, "How inspiring Pukkasati behaves. Let me question him on his understanding." Venerable Pukkasati, out of dedication to whom have you gone forth? Who is your teacher and whose Dhamma are you practicing? Pukkasati has no idea who's sitting in front of him. My teacher is Gotama the Contemplative, a Sakyan son. He is known far and wide as a Buddha, a rightly self-awakened one, who is consummate and clear knowing and of pure conduct. He is an expert of worldly affairs and the unsurpassed teacher of those fit to be taught, an important line. I have gone forth with dedication to him as my teacher, and it is his Dhamma that I am practicing. Friend Pukkasati, where is the Buddha staying right now? Wanderer, I have heard that the Buddha is in Savatthi. Have you met the Buddha? Would you recognize him? No, I have never met the Buddha, and I would not recognize him. The Buddha understood Pukkasati's devotion. Without identifying himself, he said to Pukkasati, well, I will teach you the Dhamma, friend. Listen and pay close attention as I speak. Understand where the Buddha is coming from first. He knows that Pukkasati has been studying his Dhamma, and he knows in general how far he's developed it. And so he also understands that Pukkasati is missing this key point. What is a self? And he's going to teach him.
And he was probably taught by one of the Buddha's senior disciples.
Yeah, there's no way of knowing it, likely, but he may have just been like a hanger-on, too, that was picking it up as he could. So we just don't know. And during the Buddha Sangha, very quickly after it was established, a few key teachers that developed the Dhamma rather quickly, Sariputta and Moggallana, were the first. And so they started immediately taking on some of the teaching duties that the Buddha would have taken on. And as the Sangha grew and people, individuals, developed more of the Dhamma and were then qualified to teach, they were expected to teach too. That was part of the original Sangha. It wasn't just the Buddha. He intended to have a lot of teachers. And that's something else that we're replicating here. You know, we have just four people now in teacher training to continue this thing after the cow gets me. Or I get tired of it and become a Tibetan Buddhist. The Buddha says, I wish I could be a Tibetan Buddhist. They got the best hats and the best horns and the best temples, beautiful temples. The Buddha says, a person has six properties, six media of sensory contact, meaning the six sense base, leading to 18 distinct considerations. Furthermore, a well-focused Dhamma practitioner establishes four wise determinations. Having established these four wise determinations, this one has stilled the distraction of fabricated speculation and supposition. Again, he knows, he's not just teaching this randomly. He knows that part of Pukkasati's difficulty is his influence by other dharmas that he's practiced that encourage this speculative self-establishment in non-physical realms. He's getting right to the point. When the distraction of fabricated speculation and supposition has stilled, this one is said to be a sage at peace. Listen to that line. And then again, it contains the entire Dhamma. When the distraction of fabricated speculation and supposition has stilled, this one is said to be a sage at peace. Oh, poor guy.
Buddha bless you.
Can we at least give him a funeral? The entire Buddha's Dhamma is geared towards that one thing. And when you realize that, it's not hard to understand, but you realize the foolishness of anything that would create a Dharma that distracts the mind towards grasping after non-physical and speculative establishments, ways of living in the world. It's the core problem. And that's what the Buddha's telling Pukkasati right here. And he's telling us 2,600 years later. A well-focused Dhamma practitioner should not neglect wise discernment, should always guard the truth, meaning Four Noble Truths, should always be devoted to unbinding, meaning unbinding from what? Unbinding from clinging to views that are mere fabrications, and train their minds for only one thing. Does anybody know what that one thing that we train our minds for? Hey, gold stars all over. I mean, that's it. And the reason why I'm emphasizing it is it's no more complicated than that. And when we really understand, that's what I'm developing this Dhamma for, it helps diminish any grasping after anything. Because we understand this calm mind is my responsibility. It's up to me. And then when you start understanding each factor of the Eightfold Path, you see how each and every one of them contributes in a very synergistic path for just that one purpose. To let go of any views that would give rise to a thought that could create anything other than a peaceful and calm mind.
Can you say that again?
I can't. I don't know what I said. The whole Dhamma is geared towards that one thing of letting go of any views that we're clinging to that would otherwise, I know these aren't my exact words, that would otherwise give rise to a less than peaceful mind.
Provoke,
as the Buddha yours in translation. There's nothing, the Buddha awakened, said there's nothing left in me that could provoke another moment rooted in ignorance. That's how he described his awakening. And that's how he describes it for us. We abandon all views rooted in ignorance. And that sounds like, especially at first, almost a too astronomical and momentous to even consider. But it really boils down to just one thought. Well, with a few different variations. This is not me. This is not mine. This is not myself. That's what he's teaching Pukkasati. That's what he's teaching us today. And that's what constitutes a human being. Nothing more than that. And when you apply it, well, let me get to that one. I'll explain that a little further when I get to that point. Always devoted to unbinding and train their minds only for calm. This is my summary and analysis of these six properties. The earth property. Now look at, when you look, as you're listening to this, apply it to yourself and kind of keep in the back of your mind, can I declare myself as anything more than just these six properties? And if you can, honestly, I'm not looking for an argument. I'd like to hear it, please. It'd be a great discussion. So if you think you are, let me know. These six properties, the earth property, the liquid property, the fire property, the wind property, the space property, the four elements that we live in this physical world. The space property, those other four properties need something in which to contain it and manifest, animate that. That's the space property. We can't eat without the space of our mouth, can we? We can't hear without a space between our ears. We can't digest food without the space in our intestines. Space defines form. It also defines formless, but that's for another talk. And the sixth property called the consciousness property. Can anyone define yourself in any other way that's realistic? These four earth properties, the fifth property of the space property, and consciousness. Something that is interpreting what's coming through those four properties and manifesting in the form, the space property. And so when you look at it that way, if that sixth property of consciousness is not thinking correctly, meaning in a realistic understanding of Four Noble Truths, it's then directing the four elements and that fifth property of the space property in an ignorant way. And so for the rest of that being's life, it's going to be bouncing off of walls because it doesn't know where to go. To put a slight metaphor in there. It simply doesn't understand, and it believes that it's much more than this. And therein lies the problem. That's the first fabrication. A person has these six properties. Furthermore, a person has six media of sensory contact: the eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body, and the intellect. A person has these six media of sensory conduct. Furthermore, a person has 18 considerations. This is what we need to consider as we're living our life moment by moment. On seeing form with the eye, one considers form as a basis for pleasure, or form as a basis for disappointment, or form as a basis for equanimity. And these all say basically the same thing. What an incredibly powerful statement. Again, it points directly to it's up to us how we perceive things. We can take things into our sixth sense base. In this case, the I property, the that part of the sixth sense base, sometimes often referred to as I consciousness. And if I'm grasping after pleasure or focused on aversion, meaning losing something that is pleasurable, that will determine my experience. Or if I'm holding in mind through eye contact simple equanimity, meaning a dispassionate, impersonal view of what's coming in contact with my eye, what's going to result but a calm and peaceful mind. And it is, you hear me say this often, it is at the point of contact that we practice the Dhamma. How could it be any other way? That's what the Buddha's teaching here too. As we come in contact with the world, it is based on our interpretation of what's occurring that will determine our experience of it. And so, oh, Brett's not here tonight. He sent me a great email earlier about kind of struggling with this question. If my initial focus in what I'm doing in this moment is to grasp after something that is I find pleasurable in some way, or to make sure nothing happens that's going to take away from my pleasure or safety or security or my place in the world, I'm going to be distracted towards those things, aren't I? But if I understand who I am in this moment, these six properties, realizing that no matter how hard I try, I cannot cling anything to these six properties, my mind will remain at peace because I'll stop grasping. The experience of my life may very well be the same. I very well may get a second piece of chocolate cake, but I won't need it for my happiness. And again, I'm using a silly example, but pick one. Pick one that we're distracted to believing that we must have in our lives to be happy and safe and secure and fulfilled and all the rest of it. Can't add to it. On hearing sounds with the ear, one considers sound as a basis for pleasure or sound as a basis for disappointment or sound as a basis for equanimity. On smelling an aroma with the nose, one considers aroma as a basis for pleasure or as a basis for disappointment or aroma as a basis for equanimity. And each one of our senses has its own interpretive type of consciousness, all informed by either understanding of Four Noble Truths or ignorance of Four Noble Truths. That's really the one choice we have in life as human beings. On tasting flavor with the tongue, one considers taste as a basis for pleasure or taste as a basis for disappointment or taste as a basis for equanimity. Again, what does it mean? It doesn't mean that when I taste a, think about Bonnie's tomato she gave me, if I taste an incredibly ripe tomato, it doesn't mean that I can't enjoy it. In fact, it means that I'll enjoy it so much more, but I won't need to have more of it. And I won't start thinking about a tomato that I had 3 years ago that was a little bit better. I wish this could be that good. Or, boy, this is the last of the tomatoes. I'm not going to have a good tomato until next year. You're out of your mind and you're out of your body, aren't you? Instead of simply resting in equanimity and enjoying what's in front of you. A damn good tomato. On feeling tactile sensations with the body, one considers feeling as a basis for pleasure or feeling as a basis for disappointment or feeling as a basis for equanimity. On cognizing an idea with the intellect, one considers the idea as a basis for pleasure or the idea as a basis for disappointment or the idea as a basis for equanimity. So, what's the Buddha telling us there, what we should do with our consciousness? If an idea can be the basis for pleasure, for disappointment, or for equanimity. Yes, and how do we approach that idea that's arising and passing away in our minds?
Recognize it as impermanent.
And it's not me. It's a thought. It's a thought that is in when a mind and body are still rooted in ignorance. It's a thought that is manifesting in these six properties as a thought that is provoked by ignorance.
So isn't part of the problem our belief that we can control it in because of the temporary, could be long time, temporary belief that we can control that I am in control?
Yes. Yes, and think about that. The underlying stress arises from just that I'm in control, and yet we know we're not in control. We like to believe we are. We like to believe that we can manipulate the physical world in a way that we can maintain ownership of what we want to maintain ownership of.
I can trick this thing.
Yep. Oh, and that is rooted in an ignorant view that gives rise to that type of arrogance. In fact, the uniqueness that even within a so-called Dhamma practice that leads to that is the basic problem. People try to modify this. I mean, this is what began during the Buddha's time. That's why we ended up with 1,000 different so-called dharmas. Because the example we started with, I can present this in a better way. I know better than basically an awakened human being. Or I like the way this fits into my rationality. So let me reimagine this dharma in a new way. It's just that. Rather than taking to it, understanding what the Buddha's teaching without embellishment, and simply awaken, simply develop that mind of equanimity, no matter what's occurring, whether it's pleasurable, disappointing, painful, my mind can rest in equanimity. We can be at peace with a less than peaceful mind state. These are the six considerations that are conducive to pleasure. Those are six considerations, each one of those. Does everybody see we just described 18, 3, 8, 1? Six considerations that are conducive to disappointment and six considerations that are conducive to equanimity. So what should we consider? Consider means, in a sense, it means what we should be looking for and forming a basis for our lives.
Equanimity.
Yeah. But do you see the freedom of thought in here? It's our choice. Do I want to consider only pleasure? That's the idea of, I want to see everything in a positive light, no matter what it is. Or am I stuck in such a negative view that all that I can see is all the hardship that is happening to me? That's still a personal way of taking things, aren't we? Or simply be free of all of that, of those other considerations, and have that one consideration. My mind is free and it's at peace. And continue. A person has these 18 considerations. Furthermore, a wise Dhamma practitioner has four determinations, and only four. The determination for discernment, to see things clearly. The determination for understanding the truth, four noble truths. The determination for relinquishment, letting go of fabricated views, whole Dhamma. The determination for calm. And if we can remember that those are our determinations in this moment, no matter what's occurring in this moment, it will incline our minds towards that last, towards calm. I'm not determined for these other things anymore. Excuse me. It is not my determination to get as much pleasure out of my life as I possibly can, sensual indulgence. I am not determined anymore to avoid anything and everything that might affect me in a negative way. My determination in this moment, and moment by moment as my life unfolds, is for calm. And if we remember that, we're going to get to our cushions much quicker with much more joy. We'll get to class a lot, and we'll incorporate the Dhamma in a much more gentler way, because I am now determined to do this. It's just an incredibly brilliant and simple teaching, isn't it? We each have these, if we can develop these four determinations, we've kind of won the game, haven't we? It's clear direction. A wise Dhamma practitioner has these four determinations. I'm going to skip over some of my comments. A Dhamma practitioner should not neglect discernment, should guard the truth, be devoted to relinquishment, and train only for calm. The Buddha emphasized that again. It's the second time he said that, to Pukkasati and us. And how does one not neglect discernment? Through mindfulness of these six properties. When we understand this is who we are and all we ever can be, we are not neglecting discernment. Through mindfulness of these six properties. And what is the earth property? The earth property can be internal or external. The internal earth property is anything within oneself that is hard, solid, and sustained by craving, meaning head, hair, body, nails, teeth, skin, flesh, tendons, bone, marrow, kidneys, heart, liver, membrane, spleen, lungs, intestines, the contents of the stomach, feces, and anything else internal within oneself that's hard, solid, and sustained by craving. This is called the internal earth property. Both internal earth property and external earth property are simply earth property. So that could be a little bit confusing until you understand how the Buddha started this and teaches in general. Creating an idea of a speculative non-physical establishment existence is external earth property. And the Buddha concludes that by saying it's both the same. It's both earth property. Even though the other one is just simply part of our imagination, which is occurring within this earth property. Is that clear? So even though we might imagine it and believe it and hold on to it and find a couple million people that will validate our beliefs, it's simply earth property, no matter how we want to view it.
So this might be not right at all, but so can you say that our bodies were created from the earth, meaning from the food that we eat and the meat or the plants and the water that we drink and everything. The body is constantly being created and expelled through our waste matter and things, and it's constantly going on, constantly. So our bodies are created from the earth, and when we die, I mean, our bodies do return to the earth in some way. It doesn't go anywhere else. It either gets put underneath and decomposes and stuff and whatever. So the Buddha's here saying that the earth property, meaning the properties outside of ourselves and the properties inside ourselves in this body, are the same. Is that what he's meaning? That it's
same in the general sense, yes. That we are there's nothing uncommon or special about a human body. It's made up of the same elements as a tree, a mountain, and you could say a car even. Basically, we're all manifestations of the physical environment. But when you really understand that, then how could we create anything special? There's nothing more special about me than anything else that's arisen in this physical universe.
Right, but I think he's trying to emphasize that that's why we're not special, but because we're created just from the food and the water. It's just like our bodies are just a system of.
Yeah, that's all. We are,
you know, making a body out of the environment, if you know what I mean, for a period of time until we pass away, and then just ordinary. It's part of the same thing. It's just part of the same sequence. It just goes into a body, through a body, and out again. And it's all back into the environment.
It's just that. Thank you. You expressed that beautifully. We're animated by what's available. That's all. And the speculative mind wants to go, well, what if it wasn't available, or whatever you might want to attach onto that. We have simply manifested by what's available, and it makes sense, doesn't it? How could we be anything else except what's available?
It's just science.
Yep, and the process of taking in food for nourishment and elimination and all that's simply part of it. And the same thing with thoughts and how consciousness animates what's occurring. And it boils down to, or it gets down to, that single quality of what am I holding in mind, true mindfulness. Because everything else is just completely impersonal as well. There's nothing that we can find as human beings that would identify someone as extraordinary compared to someone else. We're all just this. And we all do the same things to keep going, don't we?
Yeah, we may all be different configurations of these elements, but we're not more than that.
Yeah, and there's nothing we can do to be more than that. And the arbitrariness of that shouldn't be lost either. The arbitrariness doesn't create individuals. The arbitrariness is built into these six properties, isn't it? The earth, maybe going too far with this. The earth property is always changing, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Always. And you brought up, so are the other properties. The physical body is changing each and every moment. We are different physical human beings than we were when we first walked in here. In fact, from one moment ago, we know that. Medical science has shown that in a very brief period of time, in a matter of moments, millions and millions of physical cells are born and millions of cells fade away.
Constant state of decay.
Yes, and that's just who we are. And again, to try to make ourselves permanent, and again, this is something the Buddha recognized 2,600 years ago. He understood something that scientists are just coming to grips with now. He understood the nature of super subatomic particles, whatever you want to call it. And he said that millions of them blink into existence and blink out of existence in the blink of an eye. He understood this. So we are a constant process of this. The fact that we can identify one physical body that was born, in my case, 64 years ago and has progressed up to this point as one body, that's really an illusion, isn't it? And I haven't had 64 bodies or 64 million bodies. There's no way of counting it. But my body has always been in a constant state of change. This is a good point on something that I say occasionally. Continuity obscures impermanence, doesn't it? It looks like this is the same body that's been around for 64 years, but it hasn't. This body hasn't been around for 64 seconds.
Once a child gets beyond the basic needs, is it his parents giving him his first package of fabrications, or does he start formulating it once he's given a name?
Yes and yes. I mean, the world does that. You know, when the Buddha looked out on the world, said the world is a flame with what? The fire is a passion. He was talking about everyone, including our parents, well-intentioned. You know, my parents wanted me to grow up and be a successful human being with all the benefits they could possibly give me, just like everybody else's parents. They were lacking understanding as well, too. I can't blame them for it. But yes, our parents influence us, our schools, the whole world influences us constantly. And because the world is rooted in that same ignorance the Buddha discovered 2,600 years ago, it can't help, our environment can't help but condition us towards ignorance. But again, that's nothing different now than it ever was. We've always been these six properties. Let me continue. Internal or external within oneself that's hard, solid, and sustained by craving. This is called the internal earth property. Both internal earth property and external earth property are simply earth property. Comments? Boy, I got a lot of comments in the sutta. I must have had a lot to say. This is how the earth property should be seen by one with right discernment or right understanding. This is not me. This is not mine. This is not what I am. This is not myself. Pick anything that you're attached to. And just remind yourself to that. Anything. And if you find anything causing stress in your life, that's a good thing to remind yourself of. When one sees this as it has come to be with right discernment, one becomes disenchanted with the earth property. And through lack of sustenance, the earth property fades from the mind. It doesn't mean that the earth property vanishes. It fades from the mind, meaning we are no longer using the earth property to define ourselves to ourselves and to the world around us. That clinging attachment, that clinging to that wrong view, simply fades away.
So the lack of sustenance is...
The sustenance is ongoing ignorance.
And craving?
And craving for it, the establishment, or the continued establishment of those ignorant views in the world. That's the sustenance. That's what we feed ourselves. Remember Saturday, for those of you who are here,
right.
In the Bhava Sutta, or Loka Sutta, I can't remember which one. Karma is the field, consciousness the seed, and craving the moisture. That's what Ram's referring there too. If my thinking is still rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, and I'm continuing to crave for that continued existence, I'm watering the seeds of my own ignorance, aren't I? That's the sustenance that the Buddha's talking about. But when I recognize what I'm doing to myself, and I cut out that craving, I cut out the moisture, what's feeding the seed of my thinking, there's nothing to grow in my karmic field, is there? Another way of saying that is that's an awakened human being. We're doing it to ourselves. And again, this isn't to say that to browbeat ourselves over this, that we're such stupid or awful or confused people. This is just what we do as human beings. But we have a way out. We can recognize that it is through continually providing sustenance to wrong views that we manifest these views in our world. The earth property fades from the mind. And what is the liquid property? The liquid property can be internal or external. The internal liquid property is anything belonging to oneself that is liquid, watery, and sustained by craving. Bile, pus, blood, sweat, fat, tears, oil, saliva, mucus, urine, and anything else internal within oneself that is liquid, watery, and sustained by craving. This is called the internal liquid property, and the Buddha says the same thing. Both internal and external liquid property are simply liquid property. This is how the liquid property should be seen by one with right discernment or right understanding. This is not me. This is not mine. This is not what I am. This is not myself. When one sees this as it has come to be with right discernment, one becomes disenchanted with the liquid property, and through lack of sustenance, the liquid property fades from the mind. And what is the fire property? The fire property can be internal or external. The internal fire property is anything belonging to oneself that is fire, fiery, and sustained by craving. The internal fire property is that by which the body is warmed, ages, consumed by fever, that which is eaten, drunk, chewed, and savored, that is digested, or anything else internal within oneself that is fire, fiery, and sustained, is called the internal fire property. Both the internal and external fire property are simply fire property. This is how the fire property should be seen by one with right discernment. This is not me. This is not mine. This is not what I am. This is not myself. When one sees this as it has come to be with right discernment, one becomes disenchanted with the fire property, and through lack of sustenance, the fire property fades from mind. And what is the wind property? The wind property can be internal or external. The internal wind property is anything belonging to oneself that is wind, windy, sustained by craving. The internal wind property is rising or falling wind, wind in the stomach, wind in the intestines, wind that courses through the body, in and out breathing, or anything else internal within oneself that is wind, windy, and sustained by craving. This is called the internal wind property. Both internal and external wind property are simply wind property. This is how the wind property should be seen by one with right discernment. This is not me. This is not mine. This is not what I am. This is not myself. When one sees this as it has come to be with right discernment, one becomes disenchanted with the wind property, and through lack of sustenance, the wind property fades from the mind. And again, that's a reference to we don't vanish or we don't lose our earth elements. We simply are no longer attached to them. We're not preoccupied with them. Our minds are free and resting in equanimity. And what is the space property? The space property can be internal or external. The internal space property is anything belonging to oneself that is space, spatial, and sustained by craving. The internal, and maybe that last line says, what does it mean, sustained by craving? It simply means craving for continued existence. We're by that craving, and the seventh or eighth part of dependent origination, from craving comes clinging and maintaining, from clinging and maintaining comes becoming. So that process, rooted in craving, is continuing our self-identification with these six properties as something more than they really are. That's simply what it means. The craving isn't making something manifest in the world. It's simply manifesting our experience with what is already present. Is that clear? That's the part of craving. And we can get lost in the idea that craving somehow brings things into existence. It doesn't. It simply brings stress and suffering into existence. The space property is the holes of the ears, the nostrils, the mouth, the throat, passages whereby what is eaten, drunk, consumed, and tasted get swallowed and where it collects and whereby is it excreted from the body, or anything else internal within oneself that is space, spatial, and sustained. This is called internal space property. Both the internal and external space property are simply the space property. So again, speculating ourselves out of our body in some non-physical realm is all the same thing. It's all the same delusion. This is how the space property should be seen by one with right discernment. This is not me. This is not mine. This is not what I am. This is not myself. When one sees this as it has come to be with right discernment, one becomes disenchanted with the space property, and through lack of sustenance, the space property fades from mind. That last line, disenchanted, is probably something that when you first hear it, you don't like it. You don't want to become disenchanted. But it's a perfectly translated word from the Pali. And they used to know what disenchanted, it doesn't matter. Because what we have become by craving after and clinging to a fabricated view of self in relation to the world is we have created an enchantment for ourselves in the world. We are enchanted. Another word for that is to be mesmerized. It's like a magician's trick that we're playing on ourselves. We simply don't realize we're the magicians. So that's a perfect word to understand what we're gaining, what we're hoping to develop. Disenchantment with the things that we've been so enchanted with before. And what we've been so enchanted with for so long is fabricated views of self and nothing else. And why did we become enchanted with it? Because I thought of it. It was my idea. And we kill each other over the ideas, don't we? Not we in this room. But that's really what underlies all conflict, isn't it? Because I have an idea that you don't follow. And especially if I feel like you might be threatening my idea, and I got a big club, you're in trouble. Especially if my mind is rooted in ignorance and I feel I need to do that to survive, which is what human beings do, don't they? In the, I think it's the Maha Dukkha Kanda Sutta, the Buddha gets very graphic about this. Because of this, we kill other human beings. These are the Buddha's words from 2600 years ago. We club people to death. We cut off ears and noses, and hands and feet. And when we get caught, kings will do it to us. And yet we still do it, don't we? There's been consequences for wrong views since we've been human beings. And yet we keep trying to figure out a way to maintain the views that cause these difficulties while hoping to change these difficulties. Can't be done. That's called a person of two minds. It's really only one mind, but it's a confused mind. It's stuck in that feedback loop that the Buddha described in the Nagara Sutta. And what is the consciousness property? Consciousness free of fabrication remains pure and bright. What is perceived by consciousness? One perceives pleasure, one perceives pain, one perceives neither pleasure nor pain. In dependence on sensory contact that is to be felt as pleasure, there arises a feeling of pleasure. Let's say it again. In dependence on sensory contact that is to be felt as pleasure, meaning in dependence on sensory contact that has the intention behind it to find pleasure in what it's seeking, there arises the feeling of pleasure. What does it mean? The feeling of pleasure doesn't arise because of the object that I've acquired. The feeling of pleasure arises from my intention for that object. The object is impersonal. And it could be the most delicious piece of chocolate cake I've ever found. I'm still looking. But it's my intention that chocolate cake be the best I ever had that's either going to lead to more grasping, like, wow, this is the best, there's probably a better one out there, or it's going to lead to disappointment that this isn't as good as the piece of cake I had yesterday. And my evening will be miserable, I might kick the dog, I might have a couple of drinks over it, or something, I'm being silly. But this is what we do, because I set myself up. Because of my intention for what I was doing, rather than sitting down with a mind of equanimity and enjoying a bite of cake. Do you see the difference? I wasn't enchanted by the cake to make it be something different than it was, meaning better than or less than the past or the future pieces of cake. And I'm using a silly example. This is what we do with the objects, events, views, and ideas of our lives. In dependence on sensory contact that is to be felt as pleasure, there arises a feeling of pleasure. One perceives, I am sensing a feeling of pleasure. In dependence on sensory contact that is to be felt as pain, there arises a feeling of pain. One perceives, I am sensing a feeling of pain. In dependence on sensory contact that is to be felt as neither pleasure nor pain, there arises a feeling of neither pleasure nor pain. Excuse me. One perceives, I am sensing neither pleasure nor pain. This last may seem like something valuable, and it's not. This feeling of ambiguity where nothing has grabbed my attention enough to be distracting in the moment is what most people describe as boredom. It's this underlying feeling of, meh, nothing's really going on. I don't like something right now. There's nothing that's really got my attention as far as pleasure, and I'm not terribly disappointed. I need a distraction right now. I'm bored. That's that feeling of ambiguity. Through refined mindfulness, one understands that with a cessation of self-identification of that very sensory contact, the feeling of pleasure has arisen independent of that contact. That means as we're awakened, we understand this. What is to be felt as pleasure ceases, is stilled. It's simply what it is. Through refined mindfulness, one understands that with a cessation of self-identification of that very sensory contact, the feeling of pain has arisen independently of that contact. What is to be felt as pain ceases. It doesn't mean that a physical pain that is real is only real because I'm thinking about it. It means that my expectation and my confused determination is what's causing me to cling to this experience to be different than it is. We can be at peace with less than peaceful mind states. If what is occurring in this moment is immediately painful, a mind resting in equanimity doesn't need that to be any different. It simply is experiencing that through this six properties. It's not enchanted with that being any different than it is. It's not reacting to it. It's not causing any additional stress. It's simply there.
Mindfulness of Bahia.
Mindfulness of Bahia. And so you take another breath or two and you move into the next moment. And if the next moment the same discomfort is there, you don't lose your mind over it. You're simply present with your life as your life unfolds. It doesn't need to be any different. It's hard for some people to even think, why would I want to do this? Until you understand it's the preoccupation with pleasure and pain that has you missing your whole life. Dukkha occurs. If we insist that I only want one small fraction of my life to be experienced, meaning what I decide is pleasurable to me, and I don't want anything else, I've just decided, in fact, I've just insisted that I not have a human experience. Dukkha occurs.
And it's a lot of work.
Birth is painful. Sickness is painful. Aging is painful. Death is painful. Not getting what is desired is painful. Getting what is undesired is painful. In short, the five clinging aggregates are painful. Mm-hmm. Five clinging aggregates are the self-identification, the personal experience of suffering. I'm sorry, I talked over you.
No, I just realized that all these fabricated things we do are a lot of work.
That's stress. There's a
and
there it
stress.
Is. The exhaustion to keep up the fabrications is just that. It's exhausting. We've just found out maybe in the last 30 years medical science is starting to realize the incredibly debilitating effects of stress, and not big stress. You know, not the obvious stress. It's this subtle stress that we create ourselves out of this fabrication, out of insisting that our life only have this very narrow experience of what I decide is appropriate for me to have in my life. I'm literally walking around with my hands up saying, no, I don't want any of this. I just want chocolate cake. Don't put cherry pie in front of me. I won't like it. And I'm not even going to taste it. Because I don't want to have to change my mind that it might be good. I only want what I want, not what the world's going to give me. Or I can let go of that struggle and that stress and say, bring it on, baby. nothing's going to take this equanimity away from me because I understand. And I'm being a little silly, but that's really it. When the Buddha awakened, he literally said that. I understand. Bring it on, baby. He awakened. That's not like that. When the Buddha awakened, the depiction of that is the Buddha sitting here with his left hand facing up and his right hand facing down. What it signifies is I have overcome the world. Meaning bring it on. There's nothing, he said, there's nothing in this world that can affect me in any negative way. Not those on his words. I'm paraphrasing to make the point here. And he lived for 45 years in this mind of equanimity. The same struggles, the same strife, the same terrible things that are happening now or happening then. Maybe even more so, maybe even in a more immediate way. In other words, especially the West, we hear about wars going on. We're involved in wars going on. But during the Buddha's time, the wars were going on right next door and all around him.
And they were physically a lot more brutal.
Much more brutal. Well, I don't know, they're still, yeah, but I mean, it was a brutal, brutal time.
It was direct.
And yet, here's this human being. And remember, now, he was all alone at first. And he awakened and he realized, the world can't touch me anymore. The world cannot touch me. Why? Because he cut all ties to it. And yet, he lived in the world for 45 years, and I would say, you know, I'm probably a little biased, I'll admit it, 45 years of the most successful human life any human being has ever lived. But we're trying to do the same, you know. I might not have 45 years to continue, but I'll make the most of it. And we all can do the same thing. We all can put all that nonsense behind, all that fabrication behind, and listen to what this man is teaching us still, 2,600 years later. Maybe I can actually finish it too. What is to be felt as pain ceases, excuse me, and is stilled. Through refined mindfulness, whenever you hear me say the word refined, that's not out of the translations. I add it to make the point. The Buddha taught a very specific type of mindfulness, and it's refined mindfulness. That's why I call it that. It's mindfulness that holds in mind the Eightfold Path. Refined mindfulness, one understands that with a cessation of self-identification of that very sensory contact, the feeling of neither pleasure nor pain has arisen independently of that contact. It's simply what is occurring. What is to be felt as neither pleasure nor pain ceases. It is stilled. Again, the Buddha is saying the very same experience that in the past would have made you react to pain or react to more pleasure, craving for more, is simply seen as what arises. It's part of your life. But you don't have to define yourself by it. Just as when two sticks are brought together and agitated, heat and fire are born dependent on contact and agitation. Fire doesn't just arise spontaneously because two sticks were put together. You have to take an intentional act. When the sticks are separated and the agitation ceases, heat subsides and the fire is extinguished. When ignorance is removed from the equation, from our equation, the passions of desire are subsided. It's up to us. In this same manner, an agitated mind, lacking concentration and independence on contact, will feel those feelings of pleasure or feelings of pain or feelings of neither pleasure nor pain. A wise Dharma practitioner understands that with a cessation of self-referential sensory contact, feelings of pleasure or pain or neither pleasure nor pain are stilled. Now, there remains only a mind established in equanimity, luminous, pure, supple, and spacious. Just what we want, isn't it? Just that as if a skillful goldsmith were to take raw gold and through skillful effort transform this raw gold into a refined and flawless ornament, malleable and luminous, the gold would now suit the goldsmith's purpose. In the same manner, one whose mind is established in equanimity, luminous, pure, supple, and spacious, knows that if I were to direct my thinking towards non-physical dimensions of infinite consciousness or infinite space or an inner soul or inner Buddhahood or infinite emptiness or nothingness or the dimension of neither perception or non-perception, I would know these distracted mind states are fabricated. When you read that, and this isn't the only place the Buddha says, makes this declarative statement. When you read that in the context, it's hard to understand why we created anything that would do just the opposite. Continue creating imagined, fabricated self in non-physical realms. Here the Buddha says, don't do it. It's just rooted in ignorance. A wise Dharma practitioner does not fabricate or mentally construct for the sake of self-establishment in this physical realm or any fabricated or imaginary non-physical realms, including a reimagined Buddhism. Fabrications abandoned, this one is not sustained through craving. Moisture, the sustenance is gone. This one is released from clinging to anything in the world, including, most importantly, release from clinging to wrong views. This one is no longer agitated. Their mind is calm and well concentrated. This one knows their mind is calm and well concentrated. This one knows birth is now ended. A life well integrated with the translations usually have the holy life has been lived. And the Buddha has never taught a religion, and that has religious connotations, the word holy, although it really just means holistic. But in this sense, it means well integrated. We are whole with the Eightfold Path. A life well integrated with the Eightfold Path has been lived. My task is now complete. There's the finger. There is now nothing further for me in this world. We can all do that. Let's all do it now. Friend Pukkasati, when sensing a feeling of pleasure, understand it as impersonal and as such, impermanent. Understanding thus, craving and clinging vanish. Likewise, when sensing a feeling of pain or sensing a feeling of neither pleasure nor pain, that ambiguous feeling of boredom, understand these feelings as impersonal and as such impermanent. Understanding thus, craving and clinging vanish. In the dependent origination, since we went over dependent origination in just about every week, I mentioned this point. From craving comes clinging and maintaining. From clinging and maintaining comes becoming. And if there's nothing to interrupt that process, it simply means becoming further ignorant. But here the Buddha says, with the ending, when sensing a feeling of pain or sensing a feeling of neither pleasure nor pain, understand these feelings as impersonal and as such impermanent. Understanding thus, craving and clinging vanish. That's all we have to do. To dismantle that 12-link chain of dependencies that results from suffering rooted in ignorance, you simply abandon that. And there's some people, I've had people say that they don't like the use of that word. And people that have been traumatized by abandonment, I can understand that. It is a harsh word. And I actually, there was times when I thought maybe I should change that. But people that have that type of stress response, it's best to hear that, isn't it? Even though it might be hard. But even for the rest of us, this is a process of abandoning what will only continue to be hurtful to us, including those fabricated views.
Because it's not an active thing. It's actually leaving things behind.
Yeah.
You're not really doing anything there. You just stop doing it.
But it is active if we maintain it. In fact, it takes that effort that you were talking about to maintain it. We don't realize we're doing it, but fabricated views take constant reinforcement to maintain them. And isn't it interesting, when you start looking out at the world has developed in such a way to make that almost a requisite for living in the world, to take things personal, isn't it? I mean, every single advertisement that's out there, which is, I'm very sensitive. I always have been to advertise. I don't like it. But I think most people are. You can't get away from it, can you? And there's always a good advertiser, a good marketer knows how to put that hook in you to make it personal.
They use Epicurean techniques.
Yes.
Mute the commercials. Mute the commercials.
Well, but and then you look at the zillionaires that have grown up just in our lifetime. They figured out a way to do that on a very, very grand scale.
And they have anthropologists and behavioral science people behind.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. The founders of Facebook, I can't remember his other name, not yeah, his partner. When they were, before they published this, they had a discussion because they realized what they were doing. And they were concerned, especially the partner, I wish I remember his name, because how misleading this, how, not misleading, how indoctrinating this is going to be to children. And look what's happened. Mm-hmm. They were concerned that their, what they were creating was so powerful. But they did it anyway. And again, it's what occurred. I'm not against Facebook either. I think we should all develop the wise discernment to understand what it is, though. And along with everything else, I don't think technology has done some incredible things and technology has done some awful things. It's just, that's Duca, you know, it's really our use of it. Oppenheimer mentioned Robert Oppenheimer, who was mostly responsible for developing the nuclear bomb, which he later regretted. But also you could say that, again, not to get into the discussion, nuclear power has in some ways been incredibly helpful to all of us. So you can't say one thing is all bad. Anything. I got a little bit off point. I'm sorry.
That's the discernment.
That's the discernment. Yes. And so just as an example, I don't think I've ever directly pasted any. In fact, I know I've never pasted or never wrote anything directly on my Facebook page. It's simply there. So when I post something on becoming-buddhagut.com, it goes there. But that's really my only interest because it's a good platform for hopefully spreading this message. We'll see. Why not use it? Although, I'll get into that. I have been having second thoughts about that. Understanding and thus, craving and clinging vanish. Understanding brings the awareness that pleasure, pain, and neither pleasure nor pain are impersonal and as such impermanent and are not craved after or self-identified with. When feeling pleasure, pain, or neither pleasure nor pain, a wise Dhamma practitioner remains disjoined through lack of self-identification from these feelings. Excuse me. This one understands feelings in the body are limited to the body. It sounds almost obvious, but what does it mean? It simply means, and well, the Buddha will expand on this in just a few lines. This is what's occurring in this body. What's this body made of? Four elements, space, and my thinking. It's simply what's occurring. There's nothing else there. This feeling is limited to the feeling itself. Is that clear?
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing else around it except I attach it to it. In other words, this feeling made me feel good. I want more of what it is. Or it's just a feeling in the body. This one understands feelings are limited to human life and are limited. This one understands feelings limited to human life are limited to human life. Why is that so important? Because all these good feelings I'm having in my life, all the wonderful things that I'm attached to, just like everything else, the feelings are gone too when I'm gone. We don't take it with us. They're limited. What I'm feeling right now, what I'm experiencing right now, what I'm thinking right now, what I'm eating right now, what I'm teaching right now, what I'm learning right now, is limited to this life. Everything. Why do I want to carry around a bag of my crap when I can't? Put it down. The Buddha often talks about putting down the burden of self. It is. We talked about that. It takes so much effort to maintain a self that is completely fabricated. But it doesn't mean that it's not experienced as reality.
John, would that, even the idea of God's love for humanity fall into that?
Absolutely. It's all part of that. And
feelings limited to humanity.
Well, my notion that my notion that God loves me, and so, well, because of that, I have no fear of death. Again, you've just wasted your life. Because the thought is, even though the thought is followed by millions and millions and millions of people, it's still a fabricated thought. And I will say that even if it happens to be real, the fact that I can't experience it means that it is useless and inaccessible to me. And you know, there's more than that. You want to spend your whole life in a belief that you can never experience, okay. But that's exactly what it is. Just like a feeling is simply part of this human life, the thoughts are all part of our human life. My understanding that it's, how far is it to the moon?
That's pretty far.
I thought you might know exactly. My understanding that it's 273,000, because Tim knows the cosmos. My understanding that it's 274,000 miles to the moon, whether it's true or not, let's say it is. That's really important knowledge if I'm an astronaut. But even if I'm an astronaut, when I'm dead, the knowledge is useless, isn't it? It's part of having a human life. Any belief, even these grand beliefs, are simply part of a human life. Looking at what the Buddha awakened to, that's what he saw. That's what he understood as the root cause. All right, let me continue. Getting a little. This one understands that with the ending of life and the breakup of the body, that all that is experienced and not joined to will grow cold and end right then. And what did the Buddha just describe? Connected or clinging to these six properties and making them more than they are. And what he's saying is, at the end, at the breakup of the body, that's the end. See, don't look for anything past that. Even his teachings, both the Maha Dukkhakanda Sutta and the Mula, the Kula Dukkhakanda Sutta that we're going to get to, in, I think right after the retreat, both speak to this. It's where all these misunderstandings and misapplications of the Buddha Dhamma, in the Satipatthana Sutta, the Anapanasati Sutta, and many others, the Buddha talks about what happens on the charnel grounds and the breakup of the body, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Crows and wolves and animals picking at your bones and all that stuff. That's what he means about the indignities of after your death. What he's saying is even after you die, and this was obviously more common during the Buddhist time where they didn't bury bodies, and if you were lucky, you got cremated. Most of them weren't. After you die, the indignities, the suffering doesn't even end then, because crows and animals and the body and all that will happen. That's the Buddha's prediction of what happens after death. That.
If you look at that last line, after the end of the breakup of the body, that all of the experience and not joined to will grow cold. If it is joined to,
I don't follow what you're saying.
I mean, if the craving and the joining to all of these experiences, that then here's your.
Well, he's speaking of the release now. That at the end of that point and the breakup of the body,
mm-hmm.
when there is no craving left, that's the end of it. But there's also a karmic implication there, isn't
there? Right. So this is then the next life, which is just happens because there is.
He's not saying that.
No,
he's not saying that. He doesn't because there's an implication of it.
Yeah.
But the reason why it's never clearly established, except in a few very obscure suttas, is that it's unimportant.
Mm-hmm.
The Buddhist emphasizing you get this one life to get it right, to wake up, do it now. Stop the speculation. He says it in here. Stop the speculation. And I think he understood, based on his studying with the other teachers of his time, that they taught, mostly a salvific religion, that if you suffer in this life, it's okay because you'll get a reward here. That's a constant distraction. Excuse me. And he realized that. So he taught just the opposite. Wake up now. Yeah, who is that? Who wrote that book, Wake Up Now?
He didn't even say, don't crave, because what you're getting in the next life is just going to be same.
Yeah, but he didn't say. But he didn't say that for that very reason. Wake up, wake up. The Buddha was never concerned about anything past this human life, and it's like the Simsapa Sutta, the handful of leaves, where the Buddha says, "My knowledge is like all the leaves on the forest, not like the leaves I have in my hand." But what do I teach? I teach only that which is important to the Dhamma. And that's an important thing for all of us. It's okay to be thinking about all kinds of magical, mystical things, but do I want to awaken? Keep it focused. Keep it on the leaves in your hand. Let me continue. Just as an oil lamp burns in dependence on wick and oil, from the termination of wick and oil, it would be unnourished and cease. In the same manner, when a wise Dhamma practitioner is feeling a feeling limited to the body, they understand, I am sensing a feeling that is limited to this body. When wise Dhamma practitioner is feeling a feeling limited to human life, they understand, I am sensing a feeling limited to human life. This wise Dhamma practitioner understands that with the ending of life and the breakup of the body, that all that is experienced and not joined to will grow cold and end right then. Let me read my comment here. These last two paragraphs refer to the freedom and peace developed through the recognition and relinquishment of all self-referential views. The Buddha is describing a mind established in right view and free of any ignorance of Four Noble Truths. A mind free of fear, a fear fueled by desire, a mind resting in equanimity. The Buddha continues, in this manner, when one has the highest determination for understanding, for the knowledge of the arising and passing away of suffering and stress, this one has achieved the greatest noble understanding, knowledge of the arising and the passing away of stress. This Dhamma practitioner has gained release from all views, ignorant of Four Noble Truths. Their mind has established right view, now resting in pure truth. This view will no longer fluctuate due to distraction. This one knows whatever is deceptive and remains free from This one knows that whatever is deceptive and remains free from associating with deception. This Dhamma practitioner is established with the highest determination for truth. This one is the foremost unbinding from wrong views and is the highest noble truth. Formerly, when still ignorant of Four Noble Truths, this Dhamma practitioner foolishly craved after mental acquisitions and created self-identities clinging to these mental acquisitions. This Dhamma practitioner has completely abandoned them. Through the Eightfold Path, this one has cut fabrications off at the root of ignorance. Like the stump of a palmyra tree, now deprived of the conditions of sustenance, fabrications will no longer arise. Likewise, when still ignorant of Four Noble Truths, this Dhamma practitioner foolishly was driven by desire and self-infatuation, by ill will and hatred, by delusion and ignorance, and created self-identities clinging to these unskillful qualities. Now, this Dhamma practitioner has completely abandoned them. Through the Eightfold Path, this one has cut fabrications off at the root of ignorance. Like the stump of a palmyra tree, now deprived of the conditions of sustenance, fabrications will no longer arise. This Dhamma practitioner has established the highest determination for calm, for the calming of greed, aversion, and deluded thinking, the three defilements. This one has established the highest noble calm. This Dhamma practitioner knows to never neglect right view, to always guard the four truths, and to always train for establishing a calm and well-concentrated mind. This Dhamma practitioner understands where through wise restraint, the currents of speculation and supposition do not flow. This one is known as a sage at peace. With reference to what I am saying to you, all of the following is speculation and supposition. So if you're ever wondering if you're stuck in it, you can just refer to this. All of this is speculation and supposition. I am. Anytime you try to establish yourself permanently, it's speculation and supposition, because you can't. You know that now. I am this. I will be. That's pure speculation, isn't it? Mm-hmm. How about this one? I will not be. That's aversion to what might come. I will have this form. I always wanted to be just a bit taller so I could play center field for the Yankees. I will not have this form. I will have psychic powers. I will not have psychic powers. Buddha makes a point of that, as how foolish that is to grasp after that. Skip over that. Speculation and supposition are diseases. They're cancers. They're an arrow. By abandoning all speculation and supposition, this Dhamma practitioner is known as a sage at peace. So the Buddha is saying is, if you can't experience it directly, it's a speculation. That's what, if you ever want to read the golf ball, that's what it says. If you're wondering what's on there, you have to come up and look at it. A sage at peace is no longer distracted or agitated by birth, aging, sickness, death, sorrow, regret, greed, aversion, or deluded thinking. With no distraction or agitation, what would this Dhamma practitioner crave for or cling to? This Dhamma practitioner understands where the currents of speculation and supposition do not flow. When through wise restraint, the currents of speculation and supposition do not flow, this one is known as a sage at peace. Now, friend Pukkasati, you should remember my brief, is it brief? analysis of these six properties. Then the thought occurred to Venerable Pukkasati, surely the great teacher has come to me. Surely the rightly self-awakened one has come to me. Pukkasati rose and bowed to the Buddha and said, I was foolish, confused, and unskilled to address you merely as friend. Please accept my apology so that I may restrain myself in the future. The Buddha replied, yes, confusion overcame you, but most importantly, you have recognized your confusion and in accordance with my Dhamma have made the strong determination to end your confusion. It is just this determination, and discipline that one grows in the Dhamma and practices restraint in the future. Great teacher, please accept me into the order to follow your Dhamma. The Buddha asked him, do you have an alms bowl and robes? No, replied Pukkasati. Then gather a bowl and robes, and I will give you the going forth. The going forth simply means the acceptance into the Sangha. Pukkasati was delighted. He bowed to the Buddha and left in search of an alms bowl and robes for his ordination. While searching, this is much like Bahia, while searching, a runaway cow trampled and killed Pukkasati. A large group from the Sangha found the Buddha and told him of Pukkasati's demise. They asked the Buddha what Pukkasati's future state would be. Again, there's speculation. Friends, Pukkasati was wise. He practiced the Dhamma in accordance with my instruction. I love this next line. And he never pestered me with unrelated issues. He has abandoned the five fetters of self-identification, grasping at rituals and practices, doubt and uncertainty, sensual craving, and deluded thinking. He is now free of fabricated views and will never again be subject to the suffering born of ignorance. Those that heard these words, notice the Buddha didn't say, now he's in this realm or in that realm or some other place. The most important point is that Pukkasati will never again be subject to the suffering born of ignorance. Those that heard these words of the Buddhas were delighted. I hope you are too. Thank you. It's 8 minutes to 10. I don't know. Do we have time to go around the room?
Nine.
I'm sorry. Please. A little bit impermanent there. What do you think? Can we go around the room or should we?
I'm toast.
Nah. Me too.
Does anybody have any question or an observation they'd like to make on the class tonight? No, okay. It is kind of late. Any online, Tim or Jane?
Nope, just say thank you.
You're welcome. All right.
No, thank you.
I'm glad you both joined us tonight. Yes, Kevin.
I think that, you know, I just wanted to say what I gathered out of this summary is sort of the Buddha's providing the internal and external, the proper metaphysical context to sort of understand how wrong views and almost to use Kandana words, that anatta is subject to origination and cessation. And that's, you know, sort of what this is talking about. So that's kind of what I just thought about.
Yeah, great. That's it. And it kind of touches on what David said earlier. We may be born into this ignorant six properties. You know, I don't think any of us decided when we were 8 minutes old, okay, I'm going to live my life ignorant of Four Noble Truths. It's what occurs as a consequence of living in the world. Dukkha occurs. But as we develop awareness and we start living our lives, many of us look to try to make some understanding out of it. This is what the Buddha did. You know, he left that great life of luxury and power because things didn't make sense to him. And he figured this out. And when we understand things, when things then make sense to us, our minds are at peace. And we simply function better in the world. We're at peace. We're living stress-free. You know, understanding this one sutta, or maybe I should say holding it in mind as to who we are, helps diminish the need to attach anything to this. Because this is more than enough, isn't it? This six properties is also what animated the Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama. This six properties is part of us. And we can do the same things with these six properties as the Buddha did, or we can do whatever else we want. We're free to do it. Okay, I don't want to go too late. 9 o'clock. Wait, yes, Michael.
So then would death be a state of equanimity?
I'll explain my answer, but I want to make the answer first. The question and the answer is irrelevant. Now I got to explain it. I still got to explain. I thought you were. it's just speculation. And why would I even want to know that? Or think, maybe a better way to say it, what aspect of my mind would want to establish what happens after death?
Wrong view.
The need for permanence. Mm-hmm. And it's really that thought. What happens after death? And you think about cave people. They were figuring this out too. They, you know, poor old John, he only lived to 27, where most people live to 28. There's got to be something more. Well, maybe there is. But as the Buddha says, it's pure speculation. As human beings, we can't know it, so we shouldn't want to know it. What we should want to know is who and what we are in relation to the world we live in, which is alive. And alive with what? Alive. That's it. We are alive. We're living a human life. And when seen in that way, life is incredible. Life is magnificent. Life sucks. That's all of it. And it doesn't have to be any different. When we let go of clinging to life, we have a real connection to life. A real connection. A connection that can't be manufactured or fabricated. It simply means being a human being. And it's the only way to have that human life. It's remarkable. And it is as simple and direct, although for most of us it takes a while to work through it. Before I'm gonna close very quickly. I know it's 9. Sometimes you go a little bit later. Is everybody gaining an understanding? And I'll ask this now. I'll probably ask it a few times through this. Is everybody gaining an understanding of what it means to be a human being?
Yes.
And please tell me if you're not. There's no test here. We're not grading anybody. Does anybody feel that they're not getting an understanding of what it means to be a human being? Isn't that incredible? I think it is. I think it's amazing. It's what I wanted to know ever since I was born. I didn't know it when I was 10, 12, 13, 14 years old and angry and frustrated and full of rage because I didn't understand what I was doing in this life.
And all the explanations that you've gotten so far were very unsatisfactory.
Very unsatisfactory. Most of them were, you know, don't do anything bad and you won't go to hell. Or learn as much as you can and you'll be successful. You know, I knew people that had learned a lot and were successful and they were miserable. So again, I don't want to get into a long thing about that. Everybody is born with a desire, I think, for understanding. They're just looking in the wrong places. But the Buddha figured it out, and he left these incredible teachings for us to do the same thing. And the reason why I asked that question is twofold. I want to know that you're getting it, but I want you to know you're getting it. It's working, and that's remarkable. That's enough for tonight. we'll continue with our series next on Saturday. I think the Saturday is Wise Restraint. And I know it's impossible for many of you to come to two classes a week, but I do hope you're catching up when you can on the other classes. And our retreat's coming up. If you're going to go, sign up quickly, please. And we'll finish with metta, as we always do. The Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, excuse me, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class tonight. Peace. Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.